Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan. And in for Amy J this morning is former state representative and GOP congressional and gubernatorial candidate Jeannie Ives, now at breakthrough-ideas.com. You hear her reveille commentaries on our program.
Reveille is a wake-up call in the military, and there's nobody who needs it more than Illinoisans.
There's no question about that, and we'll talk a little bit about that in the context of J.D. Vance's announcement that he's running for Hillbilly Elegy author. J.D. Vance's announcement he's running for the Republican nomination for U.S. Senate to replace Rob Portman in Ohio. We'll talk about that a little bit later. But I wanted to pick up on a conversation we had yesterday, Jeannie, with that professor from IIT. We talked to a structural and civil engineering professor from IIT about the Surfside condo collapse, of course. And this rush in the wake of tragedy to assign blame or to be seen as doing something. If you're not in the business of assigning blame or trying to advance a political agenda, then you're in the business of saying, we should do this or we should do that. It's not necessarily evidence-based. It's more like there was a, you know, a 40-year recertification of electrical and structural integrity for buildings in Florida. And the professor we spoke with yesterday, well, that should be less because for bridges, it's 2 years. He didn't have how many years it should be for buildings, but he just said it should be fewer than 40 years. Maybe that's true. I'm not an engineer. Maybe there's a newer, better understanding of best practices when it comes to doing stop, look, and listens about structural and electrical integrity of condo buildings and similar buildings. But maybe it's also just like, let's do something. And since we didn't catch, the collective we, didn't catch how bad a shape that condo building was in before it collapsed, clearly, let's just move in the the dates, the re-updates, so we're seen as doing something that we can call reform. Whether or not that's evidentiary, whether or not there's any evidence to support that or not, and I just,
they're not going to go all the way here.
Well, I just want to, especially when you still have 150 people missing, I still like to process, ask questions, figure out what we're trying to. What we understand and what we're trying to understand, as opposed to this rush to do something, this rush to assign blame. Of course, class action lawsuits have already been filed because the trial lawyers are the worst offenders at rushing to assign blame in the Western world, which is why they're generally properly seen as parasites and no better than the politicians that are trying to advance their pre-existing political agenda, as Governor DeSantis said when he was queried about it by Martha McCallum, specifically what Granholm had to say about, well, we can't rule out climate change.
I don't think there's any evidence of that. I mean, what we want, Martha, is we want the truth about what happened so that we know if it has implications for other properties in Florida and if there needs to be anything to remedy it on the state level or local level. But what we're not going to do is use this to try to advance any pre-existing agenda. There's no agenda here. We want the facts, we want the truth, and we want to know what needs to be done to be able to protect other folks who may be living in other types of buildings. Yeah. I will say this, Florida and particularly South Florida has some of the strongest building codes in the country because we have to have that with hurricane season every year. And I have confidence that what's being built up and down this coast is being done very, very well. Obviously, this building was in the early 80s, but I can tell you we take it very seriously down here.
Well, listen, it's interesting because you're still having bodies pulled from the rubble. You still have families, you know, in grief. And all of a sudden, you've got this finger pointing already happening. Why? Because there's money on the line, from the lawsuits to assigning blame. If you can shift the blame to climate change, well, gee, maybe the government will come in and bail out everybody on it. And then you don't have this concern with the insurance companies that insured the building and the building owners going bankrupt. I mean, I think that this is always the case, but it's really a sad testament. Now, DeSantis, what a measured, reasonable voice in the entire discussion here. I just find him so refreshing compared to any other politician. And
We're trying to understand what's true rather than just offering suppositions. It could have been aliens. It could have been climate change. It could have been this. It could have been that. There's no evidence to support any of these.
Well, now it's been suggested that the testing of the USS Gerald Ford, 100 miles off the coast of Florida, created an earthquake that possibly created the collapse. Have you heard that one?
I hadn't heard that one.
Yes. Yes.
There's some things that are being suggested. We asked about this yesterday that may be contributing causes, like the construction going on nearby, and residents were complaining about that. So we have some basis to ask questions about that, not to say this was it, but to do what DeSantis said, which is we're trying to figure this out. It's, you know, so let's be, you know, one foot in front of the other here when you have so many variables against the backdrop of the immediate charge, which is to address the missing and the grieving. And, you know, I don't know. I just, in the wake of these, whether it's Katrina or something like this, natural disasters, hurricanes, what happened in Puerto Rico, the Bahamas in the recent years. The earthquake in Haiti. I mean, you know, we have some better ideas there because of the nature of construction in third world countries versus like South Florida. But it's just like, can you just focus on the questions that you have, the answers you're trying to get, and bring people along as you search for those answers and provide those answers as you obtain them, rather than this preening before the cameras. This and the other thing too, and Biden did this yesterday during his stop. Sort of like the need to say something because you're our father, you these politicians, it's like sentimental pap you get from Biden. Listen to this with DeSantis sitting next to him.
Can I say just one more thing? You know what's good about this? We're willing to cooperate. We're letting the nation know we can cooperate.
Yes, sir.
And what is really important, what's really important, is talking to Debbie about it right now. Come together. This is life and death. And so I don't think I just got back from about 12 days in Europe. They wonder whether we can do this. And you're doing it. I mean, just the simple act of everybody doing whatever needs to be done is it really makes a difference. So.
Well, thank you, Mr. President. And you recognize the severity of this tragedy from day one, and you've been very supportive.
That's nice. You know what the silver lining in this, Jeannie? What we're doing in this conference room. You know what the silver lining is? We're me and you sitting here talking about it. The silver lining is us, is what we're doing, the politicians, backslapping each other, telling each other how much each other cares. How responsive we've been. We're supportive. What does even supportive mean? Resources, FEMA. Yeah, I know. That's sort of built into natural disasters. You don't get credit for that. And stop looking for credit. Just talk in concrete terms. No pun intended. Seriously, no pun intended. Talk in concrete terms. Not this like, you're supportive, I'm supportive, we've had good conversations. We're showing the world we can cooperate. We can be friends. It's so patronizing.
What's the reference to Europe? I mean, he's off topic all the time, though.
He was in Europe, and in Europe, you know, doesn't know if America's going to survive, doesn't know if America can cooperate anymore. But they have renewed confidence because, you know, the great...
He's painful to listen to.
The great conciliator, Joe Biden, is in the Oval Office now. He's just a doddering old man. And he, by the way, he was a doddering old man at 30, too.
So do you think they'll possibly look into shoddy construction or somebody got paid under the table? I mean, that's where my mind went to, because, of course, I'm from Chicago area.
Well, yeah.
You know?
But, you know, I don't know. From what the public documents that have been released from the condo association and stuff, I mean, it seems like there were attempting
signs.
To be conscientious, though. And, I mean, and these are not experts on these condo associations, as we talked about with the professor. Not everybody's a structural and civil engineer. We're describing what's happening. We're memorializing it in communication with somebody we're potentially contracting to do this renovation and maintenance and so on and so forth. I mean, the experts saying, well, we can't really know until we really get in there. You see some of the peeling of the concrete, but we won't really know until we get in there and see it and so on and so forth. Should it have taken, more than a year to retain this vendor to do this work? That's hardly unheard of when it comes to condo associations and the speed at which they move, which is very much like government. So I don't know, you know, I just think that I don't want to be a trial lawyer. I don't want to be a politician when it comes to this stuff.
No, but we've built big government, Dan. Across the United States, we've built these big bureaucracies. We've built the entire building inspection apparatus. And then it feels like, though, when it was critical, government failed again. And that's where I kind of go. I mean, because you spend real money on all these training programs for everybody to fill out their checklists and make sure it's right and all this inspection stuff. And then when it really mattered, it failed. I mean, that's my problem. I mean, people put so much trust in government, and government is largely failed it from the COVID stuff to the mask stuff to vaccinations, it appears to me now, to
stuff. It's a reminder that these are not superhumans.
That's right.
They're just the jerk next door. They're just fallible, just like you are. Public virtue, private vice that becomes public virtue once you ascend to an elected or appointed position. That's the faulty thinking that needs to be addressed in this country, generally speaking.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Your show keeps me alive during the week. There's nobody I'd rather listen to between 5 and 9 in the morning than you guys.
On AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, and happy Independence Day and Independence Day weekend in advance of Independence Day on Sunday, right? Today's the 2nd?
Yes.
Sunday. The 4th. This weekend, obviously, most of your Democrat Socialist friends will be remembering and reflecting on the 100-year anniversary of the Chinese Communist Party. One of them will be Ilhan Omar, to be sure. She's very focused on holding the United States, along with terrorist organizations, or she might say other terrorist organizations, accountable for their crimes against humanity. This is something that bubbled up to the surface this week, and it's now being kicked around a bit. Psaki was asked about it. Omar with Jake Tapper being queried about her comparison of the United States to the Taliban, Israel, comparing Israel, of course, being the anti-Semite that she is, to the Taliban and other terrorist organizations. When it comes to support for the International Criminal Court to hold war criminals like the Republican Party accountable for their crimes against humanity, Omar with Tapper.
You upset, as you know, many of your fellow House Democrats after comments you made earlier this month about the U.S. and Israel. You were questioning Secretary of State Blinken about where victims of war crimes could get justice. You made comments to him, and also you tweeted, quote, "We must have the same level of accountability and justice for all victims of crimes against humanity. We have seen unthinkable atrocities committed by the U.S., Hamas, Israel, Afghanistan, and the Taliban," unquote. Ultimately, Democratic leaders said that equating the U.S. and Israel with Hamas and the terror and the Taliban, quote, foments prejudice. And as you know, a group of Jewish House Democrats wrote a letter to President Biden saying that accusing Israel of acts of terror, as you and other members of the squad have done, is anti-Semitic. Do you regret these comments?
I don't. I think it's really important to think back to the point that I was trying to make. Obviously, I was addressing Secretary of State Blinken. The cases are put together in front of the ICC. ICC has been investigating. I know that, you know, some of my colleagues don't lend legitimacy to the ICC, but I tend to think that people around the world who have experienced injustice need to be able to have a place where they can go. And as a country that helped found the ICC and supported it, I think that it is really important for us to continue to find ways in which people can find justice around the world.
Yeah, people who have been victims of criminal conduct, they need a place to go for redress. In this country, Representative Amar, we have a court system. That's where they go. The International Criminal Court. If you commit a war crime, you know this, Jeannie, yes, better than I do, then you have the Military Court of Justice.
That's right.
We have our criminal justice system. We have our civil justice system. The ICC, number one, I mean, just to show her sort of rank ignorance, or maybe to tell about her real appreciation for the American system of justice as opposed to the International Criminal Court, since we're citizens of the world. But also, all the focus on Omar's comments I found interesting was her notorious anti-Semitism, comparing Israel to Hamas, Israel to the Taliban. How about just the fact that she, you know, Jewish members of her party in the House Democrat Socialist Caucus saying we're troubled by the comparison. Is anybody troubled by the comparison she makes of America to the Taliban, of America to Hamas? And does she regret? No, she doesn't regret it. Of course she doesn't. I love the, hey,
wait a minute. So
don't believe what she's saying, even when she says, believe what I'm saying.
So the Republican Party, actually the Democrats and even Republicans, absolutely disavow everything Marjorie Taylor Greene has said or done. They take strip her of all her committees. And this, and Ilhan Omar gets away with this, and nothing happens to her. Nothing.
Well, because she didn't mean what she said, even after she said, I mean what I say.
Thank you, Jen. What does the White House think about Congresswoman Ilhan Omar saying that she does not regret comparing Israel to Hamas and the Taliban?
Well, any attempt to draw an equivalency between the United States and our close ally Israel with a terror group like Hamas or the Taliban is false and unacceptable. Representative Omar has said that was not her intent of her comments.
That's exactly what she said.
Those
though
certainly are not comments that we've made from here.
Do you regret making that comparison? No, I do not regret it. She didn't mean to say that, and she said that wasn't her intent. I mean, so it's just like, well, we have a disagreement. We wouldn't have said it, but that wasn't her intent. We're going to ascribe the intent we wish she had onto her, because the intent she actually has is not defensible.
Well, I don't know how Jewish Democrats can actually put up with this much longer.
I don't know about American Democrats and American Republicans.
I think you need to separate the two. I actually think many of the Democrats have some of the most un-American policies and thoughts. And I mean, if they're going to allow this to happen and then MTG gets stripped of her committees, and I'm not, you know, going to be here defending MTG all the time, but honestly, the comparison needs to be made.
Well, you know, imitation is the sincerest form of flattery. And what you elevate, you propagate. Let me introduce you to a gentle lady from Kings County, Washington State. She is a candidate for King County Council. She's Ubax Garhir. She's also Somalian. Of Somalian descent. I hope I'm pronouncing her name right. She running for Kings County City Council. So county post there in Seattle, where they just are finishing up enjoying their summer of love from last year. She's been endorsed by present and former Democrat socialist politicians there. State Senator Rebecca Saldana, Mike O'Brien, former Seattle council member, calls her an amazing leader. Rebecca Saldana, state senator, says, "I will follow Ubax anywhere." Really? Seattle City Council member, "Ubax is the kind of leader who inspires you to be your best." SEIU.
Yep.
The Purple People Beaters. Mm-hmm. She's dedicated to bringing equity and equality and so on and so forth. Well, in 2010, she boarded a school bus full of middle schoolers. Highline School District bus, January 12, 2010. Post-Millennial has the story. It was about to begin its morning route to Chinook Middle School there in the Seattle area. She walks onto a school bus filled with children. She tells the bus driver not to drive because it's a matter of national security. She tells him the bus is not leaving. And the bus driver calls police, but it takes a while for them to get there, police to get there. She has to be pulled off the bus at gunpoint after threatening that she may have a bomb on a bus full of middle school children.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I need the police at 208 and Pacific Highway.
She gets into a shouting match with the kids on the bus who want to leave and go to school. "I might have a bomb. I might have a gun." You don't know. She's screaming at them. They ultimately file out of the back door of the bus. She's at the front of the bus. And she's screaming at them, calling them cowards as they're filing out. And then a police officer arrives.
"I have a problem. This lady said that she had a bomb. She's national security. I don't care what you want. I'm going to tell you right now, these are children on the bus, and I'm going to ask you to get off the bus right now. I'm going to ask you once, and then I'm going to take you off the bus. If you choose not to get off the bus, I'm going to drop you right here as we stand. Do you understand that? Okay, then what I would do is back up off this bus right now. Turn around, face the police. All right, start backing up. Start backing up. I'm only going to tell you once.
Did you catch that with the officer? She says, "I'm prepared to die." And he said, "I don't care if you're prepared to die or not. I'm not prepared to kill you. So how's that?" And then he takes her off the bus.
Restraint.
That was 12 years ago, or 11 years ago, 2010. And now, she's the most popular Democrat socialist running for Kings County Council.
But Dan, it gets even better. She is now the director of the City of Seattle Office of Planning and Community Development, earning over $130,000 a year.
She sure is.
So those antics, this is what it gets you.
Well, you know, she has addressed what happened in 2010, saying that people are exploiting mental health issues. She was a new mother, and it was postpartum depression. So if you like Ilhan Omar and the rest of the socialist Spice Girls, Ayanna Pressley and MF-er Spice from Michigan there, Rashida Tlaib, and obviously the front girl, AOC, you're going to love Ubax Gardeer. And as we know, you know, those who wind up in Congress start usually at the local level. They're the city council member, the school board member, the county board member that becomes the state legislator, that becomes the congressman, that becomes a real national problem. It's just remarkable. And you think these cities like Seattle or Portland or Chicago are salvageable? These are you know, free and fair elections. These are the choices being made in the Western world.
Do you really think, though, do you think that the majority of people, even living in Seattle, even know about this? But they obviously don't even care. I mean, this, on top of it, this lady, she co-wrote a letter which referred to the ultra-progressive Seattle Mayor Jenny Durkan as a dictator. And she again referenced her mental health. And then she says this: "We're done being women of color bearing a disproportionate emotional labor burden in our civilization's collective reckoning with our midlife crisis." I mean, she's making $130,000 a year and she seems like she's a train wreck. This is ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the bomb threat on a school bus full of middle school kids, probably a tip off. Yeah.
You think?
Probably. Maybe that's a disqualifier. But that's me. I'm old school. I say, you know, if you make a bomb threat against a school bus full of middle school kids, or anybody for that matter, but particularly middle school kids, then, you know, I don't know if I want you representing my interests in public office. But I'm a bit persnickety.
Dan, but Illinois gives you James Kilgore.
Otherwise known
as John Pape, who, you know, is now a research scholar at the University of Illinois.
Absolutely.
And this is after he was involved with the Symbionese Liberation Army, a left-wing American terrorist organization, participated in the killing of a woman and then fled for 27 years, finally getting caught. And now the University of Illinois finds him worthy of being a research scholar.
Well, I'm used to having terrorists in academia in this state. This is where they go at Bernadine Dorn, Bill Ayers, Kilgore. Public office, gosh, I don't know. You know, again, maybe I'm just not with the times. Apparently, she also went to an event in Seattle where they were lamenting the failure of the Holocaust. But, you know, SEIU says she's dedicated to bringing equity and equality, so that's good enough for me.
What party do you think she affiliates with?
ISIS? Vince in St. Charles.
Good morning, guys. I think it's not the bomb, it's because she's a woman of color that you guys are picking on her. And the other thing is, okay, that's why I tell my friends, okay, this is the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party is not the party of Hoffa anymore. This is the Democratic Party. They're anti-police. They're for open borders. And they're these people, Omar.
And for threatening middle school children, apparently, by the way.
Well, that helps. Yeah. That doesn't hurt.
Yeah,
so
sure.
So there you go. They're not paying attention, my friends. I don't know what their problem is, but... this is the Democratic Party now.
Thanks for the call. Maybe Al-Shabaab. Maybe she's Al-Shabaab, not ISIS. I don't know. Obama was lamenting the possibility we could lose our two-party system. Well, maybe Omar and Gardhir will replace it with something more to their liking.
The ungratefulness of these women who have come to America for all that it represents. I mean, just the simple ungratefulness is astounding.
Well, they've come here to deliver a reckoning, a long overdue reckoning to America for all of her war crimes. Marvin in Burlington.
Hey, how are you guys this morning?
Good.
Yeah, the Jewish Democrats, they're so secular. They're not even, I don't even know, I think they just use it to try to get votes from the Jewish community, but they're not religious. They're worshiping their secular religion of progressivism and liberalism, and that comes first. And that's all that matters to them. And how is America making a mistake? How are we making mistakes as a country by producing people like this? They're let in through the immigration system, and we don't teach them civics, and they don't appreciate our country. What are they doing here to begin with? I mean, these people should be screened and not allowed to be citizens. They're really traitors. I mean, a few decades ago they'd be traitors and considered traitors and deported.
Marvin, thanks for the call. Brian in Oak Forest.
Hey, real quick question. Was that woman arrested, charged, and spending time in prison for that threat?
She was arrested. She was charged. She pled down to a misdemeanor. No jail time.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Thanks for the call, Brian. I mean, you know.
She had a mental health crisis.
Yeah, we don't want to criminalize mental health issues.
That's right.
Oh, okay. Well, that's real good to know.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan, and in for Amy J. this morning, former state rep and GOP congressional and gubernatorial candidate Jeannie Ives, now at breakthrough-ideas.com. And Jeannie, I'm sure this will come as no surprise to you. The NEA, that's the National Education Association, that's the largest teachers union in the country. Or I think maybe IFT is actually, but one of the other teachers union. The NEA will call for mandatory, safe, and effective COVID-19 vaccinations and testing for all students and staff before returning to face-to-face instruction in the fall, subject to medical exceptions. Mandatory, safe, and effective COVID-19 vaccinations and testing for all students and staff before returning to face-to-face in the fall. What say you to that?
Well, in full disclosure, the IEA, which is a subsidiary of the NEA, spent, donated over $70,000 in a primary in 2014 to try and take me out of office because I think school districts and parents should run schools, and the IEA wants to run all the schools. So they're my nemesis. Don't trust them at all. I think they're terrible, terrible people who run that place. And I think any teacher who is part of the IEA ought to get out of it ASAP.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm. So that's what I think.
Yeah.
And, of everything that they say.
And mandatory, safe, and effective COVID-19 vaccinations for all students. So pre-K through 12. Pre-K.
I guess so.
Okay. And testing. Again, here's where the unions and the politicians that are beholden to them are not following the science and data. Oh, heavens. CDC, WHO said no to testing for asymptomatic infections.
Listen, and, you know, the whole purpose behind all this is to keep them in control of the schools and the situation and to lock things down when they want to lock it down and go on Zoom and not be accountable, and that's where we're at. I mean, all these folks want... You know, talk about no testing. That's exactly what they want. They don't want the school kids to be tested for all the loss of learning that happened over the last year.
How about no testicles? That brings us to Hinsdale District 86, which I believe has been depopulated of fathers. Are there any fathers in Hinsdale that send their kids to District 86? I mean, I know there are fathers that send their kids to the private schools, but... Are there Hinsdale Central or the District 86 generally? Are there dads out there in these well-to-do suburbs? I don't know. Tammy Prentice is your school overlord, District 86, and she's got questions. She doesn't know what to do. This is a missive she just sent out, like, yesterday afternoon. Dear District 86 community, I prefer family. You know, I like to think of my government overseers as my family, my extended family. But okay, community. You're building community out there in Hinsdale, aren't you? During the past few months, superintendents from across DuPage County have been imploring our state leaders to adopt a more logical and reasonable approach for managing COVID-19 in schools. It's not my fault.
Nope.
I'm just a superintendent of your school district. What do you want me to do? While our discussions and interactions with those leaders have been promising, clearly, significant questions still remain about a number of critical topics, including masks. We need clear direction on who needs to wear them and when. This is highlighted by the inconsistent information featured in the recent executive order from Governor Pritzker and the updated guidance by the Illinois Department of Public Health and Illinois High School Association. She's baffled. Tammy Prentice And all the families in the District 86 community, all of those well-to-do, successful professionals, smart, smart, smart people, all.
Yep.
They are perplexed. They know not what to do. Who needs to wear the mask when? Governor Pritzker? Dr. Ezekiel? Can somebody help me? Should I send my kindergartner to with a mask to the playground or not? I don't know. Tammy Prentice doesn't know. Nobody knows.
Dan, she's got a doctorate. They all have doctorates. They're smarter than you.
I know. That's what I'm saying. That's why I'm saying Tammy Prentice is smarter than me and Governor Pritzker is smarter than her. Mm-hmm. So we just need to continue going up the food chain. And that's an appropriate metaphor when we're talking about Pritzker and say, what do we do? I'm paralyzed. We're just huddled in the corner of our mansion, not knowing what to do because does Johnny wear the mask? Does he not wear the mask? Social distancing. That's not her only question. She's confused about everything.
Yeah, but Dan, here's the deal. Do you remember a few years ago, we were downstate together at an event with some Southern Illinois state reps, and you basically said, look, you folks down here are going to be where the revolution starts in the state of Illinois to take it back. Well, in contrast to D86, you have the Red Hill School Board essentially saying that we are going to make masks optional. We're going to let parents decide what's going to happen. And in response, the Illinois State Board of Education put them on probation.
Yeah,
and
right.
So they're going to have a hearing on July 8th. And if they, you know, this eventually, if they don't comply with ISBE's mask standards, they could eventually close this public school.
Let's see.
You do have some people with some guts doing the right thing. But then you have these absolute.
I know.
I guess I don't want to call them Karens. They're just because that's wouldn't be nice to Karens. But idiots running school boards. They're cowards. 100% cowards.
Yeah. I mean, the good Superintendent Prentice, social distancing. We need greater consistency and alignment, most notably in the guidance for classrooms and what is used to determine close contacts. Does anybody know an infectious disease expert in Hinsdale?
There's no doctors in Hinsdale.
No doctors in Hinsdale. So we're relying on the pediatrician who's the head of the Department of Public Health. To tell you what to do about infectious diseases, about viruses, is that right? We're relying on Jelly Belly, noted epidemiologist J.B. Pritzker?
Walking comorbidity.
I can't get answers to this question. We need greater guidance. This is funny, too, because this is all part of this charade that's been going on. Oh, no. We don't give orders, so we're just public health professionals. We provide guidance, and then the local school districts make their decisions. That's not how it works in practice. Tammy Prentice doesn't know up from down. She's waiting to be told what to do from on high, from the pediatrician and the fat scion of the Hyatt Hotels on high. We don't know what to do about social distancing. Lunch. We don't know. We need to know that what distance
right.
must be maintained in locations where people are eating lunch. Is it the 6-foot rule? We're nonplussed.
I would never go to war with any of these people. Can you imagine?
Lockers and equipment. We need to know if there will continue to be restrictions on the use of lockers and sharing equipment and supplies. I don't know, Tammy. I mean, we've only known for 14 months that it doesn't transmit on surfaces, but I can understand how you're baffled. It's the most amazing email that she sent out. She's a serious person. All these people receiving this email in Hinsdale District 86 are a serious people, right?
Well, you know, people probably don't know this,
okay.
But Dr. Carmen Ayala, who is the head of the Illinois State Board of Education, in her previous education life, she was the superintendent of Berwyn School District. When she was the superintendent for all those years, guess what? Only 25% of the kids did math at grade level. Only 25%. And she was elevated now. She's the one making all these decisions for all the school children around the state of Illinois. And, you know, so that's who's in charge. That's who's making decisions on your kids.
Hey, they don't have time to worry about proficiency in reading and math. They're in the business of saving lives. Like Chuck Todd. Chuck Todd, the yapping terrier on Meet the Press, had this to say about you who are tardy in getting your vaccinations.
Director Walensky says more than 1,000 counties have a vaccination rate lower than 30%. Folks, nearly 10,000 people died in the month of June. They were needless deaths. Please get vaccinated. If you know someone who's not vaccinated, find a way to convince them to get vaccinated. Literally, the only people dying are the unvaccinated. And for those of you spreading misinformation, shame on you. Shame on you. People are needlessly dying because of your misinformation. Think about it. I don't know how some of you sleep at night who are doing this for a living on television.
Oh, boy, I am really put back on my heels. Hey, Chuck, well, first of all, I don't know, a guy died from a blood clot after taking the Moderna vaccine. It was just reported yesterday, and there's, you know, estimates in the thousands of people who have died as a with approximate cause being taken the vaccination. But that's even secondary. Here's who Chuck Todd is, and here's who most of these functionaries, whether they're in the media, these COVIDian enthusiast functionaries in the media or in government. Here's what they are. They're the equivalent of the hate crime hoaxer. They decry what they propagate. That's what Chuck Todd is. So let's talk about misinformation in this context, because it's the same thing with all this, you know, uncertainty about social distancing and mask wearing. And I need to be told what to do. Really good piece, which I tweeted out, by Alex Gutentag at Tablet Magazine, The War on Reality. And we've talked about many of these figures before, but they bear repeating in the face of the you're perpetuating misinformation. You're putting misinformation, and how dare you, and how can you sleep at night? Okay. So where do Americans get the completely wrong, exponentially, you know, wrong impressions that they have about COVID? In December of 2020, 35% of Americans believe that half of the people with COVID required hospitalization. A third of Americans believed one half of those infected with COVID required hospitalization. The correct hospitalization figure at that time, 1 to 5%. Off by a factor of 10 or 50, 10 to 50. Americans estimated the share of COVID-19 deaths for people 18 to 24 was 8%. It was 0.1%. I'll go on. The media compared COVID-19 to the 1918 influenza, 1918 Spanish flu, right? That's the comparisons. And by the way, Trump was guilty of this too. The average age of death, Spanish flu, 28. The average age, COVID, 73. And so the continued discussion of in the context of vaccinations, making no distinctions by age cohort, which we've known for a long time, there are massive differences in the threat COVID poses based on age, even setting aside comorbidities, but then adding them in. CDC projected a one-year decrease in life expectancy for the U.S. population. We reported that here. CDC, mm-hmm, relying on the experts.
Yep.
The overall decrease in life expectancy was only 5 days. The U.S.'s excess mortality in 2017 was greater than its excess mortality in 2020. So how do we not understand? How does so much of the population not understand these facts, the data, Chuck, Tammy, Hinsdale 86, and all the other COVIDians? Because of fearmongers like Chuck Todd and hacks in positions of authority in public health departments like Ezekiel and politicians who prey on people's fear for political benefit like Jelly Belly and Triple Threat and nipple rings in New York and the Ava Perone of East Lansing in Michigan and on and on. You want to go chapter and verse on facts and misinformation? Let's do it.
Mm-hmm.
Frank in Arlington Heights.
Good morning, Dan, Jeannie. I think you're being a little sarcastic, Dan.
Did you pick up on that?
I, I'm out here in District 214. We have an award-winning administration. we have the National Superintendent of the Year. These people are smart. They're just so informed, and they're such. And we have a board that is just full of incredibly intelligent and caring people. That they're going to figure out the right thing, Dan. They're absolutely going to figure out. I have complete confidence in my board. I mean, they figured it out last year, didn't they?
Yeah.
In 2019-20.
Now,
by the way, by the way, Jeannie, Bolsheviks is the name to call them, not Karens. That's what she's called.
Oh, yes, okay. I'll use that.
They're
yeah.
Bolsheviks.
I'll subject that. Yeah.
You know, Frank, I mean, I hate to turn the tables on you, but am I detecting a little sarcasm from you now? Was that
cynicism, like Diogenes, back from the original cynic, Diogenes from Athens.
Yes, thank you for the call, Frank. Appreciate it. Dawn, I don't think she likes the sarcasm. Dawn, Crystal Lake.
Yes, good morning, Dan. Good morning, Gene.
Morning.
Good morning.
I am going to echo the concern about sarcasm, and I hope you will bear with me while I say this.
Yes.
I'm going to try to say it nicely.
You don't have to.
I'm going to try to say it nicely. I don't know if I'll be successful.
All right. Good luck.
Our state, the citizens of our state, the residents, our families have undergone an unprecedented psychological attack. They've been locked in their homes a year, longer than a year. Our lives have been disrupted. Everything has been smashed for many families. Many people do not have family members to assist them, or have family members who have broken off from the family because of ideological and political events. There are many people trapped in their homes, psychologically unable to get out, who can't function, who are mentally ill, who are physically ill because they've suffered heart attacks or strokes or something. What is the plan for checking on our people, actually physically going to people's homes to make sure they're okay, to see if anybody needs assistance, how to get them the assistance so that they aren't dependent on government? I'm still waiting after 6 years of being injured on my cervical spine and being made paralyzed, quadriplegic for over 3 years. I'm still waiting for somebody to respond to my request for help. Now, prior to 2014, when I was originally injured in the anti-police violence of that year, when a small exploding device was deployed in a public library in Oak Park, okay, that was in 2014, I am still waiting for someone to respond to my request for assistance. We need to stop mocking people and being sarcastic. We need to start taking care of our own people, because when we do not take care of our own people, they end up going on government assistance and they become dependent on Democrats.
All right. Thanks for the
ongoing sarcasm. Ongoing sarcasm is not going to work anymore, Dan.
Yeah. Dawn, we got to go. Thanks for the call. Let me tell you something. I'm, of course, caring for people and government services, living up to the commitments that mm-hmm. they make and so forth, all for that. Being sarcastic and ridiculing those who so richly deserve to be ridiculed, that is a important intellectual and rhetorical weapon. So I disagree with you. I appreciate your position. I'm sorry for your position. But providing services and also holding up people who so richly deserve to be mocked for the mockery they so richly deserve, not mutually exclusive. And I don't know what it takes to penetrate the consciousness of these supposed compassionate, intelligent people that populate Chicagoland. So if you got a better idea that would be more effective, or let me know. Please let me know. Until then, I'm just going to entertain myself, because nobody seems to be listening anyway.
This is the morning show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. When you've got questions, he always has an answer. It's Sean Hannity. This afternoon at 2 on AM 560. The Answer.
Good morning, Dan. And in for Amy this morning, former state rep and GOP congressional and gubernatorial candidate Jeannie Ives. And Jeannie, as we mark our nation's birthday on Sunday, it's interesting that perhaps the most profound example of a commitment to living as a free person is a man sitting in a prison in China right now. Jimmy Lai. He is the self-made billionaire who was thrown in prison for disagreeing with the Chinese communists. Our friends, the Chinese communists. And our adversaries, but really our friends. We need to work with them, but we also need to defeat them. The mixed message you get from the Beltway. No mixed message from Jimmy Lai. He's in a prison cell in Hong Kong. His newspaper, we've talked about a couple times over the last couple weeks, Apple Daily, shut down by the communist apparatchiks. Doesn't much care. I mean, he cares, but he understands that there are more important things than his money and his newspaper. Some of what he's had to say is really reminiscent of Alexander Solzhenitsyn and his 2 decades plus in the Soviet gulags. Jimmy Lai recently told Economic Strategy Institute President Clyde Berkowitz, "The communists think they can buy or intimidate everyone off, create their own reality, write their own history. Sound familiar? Effectively, they assume the role of God. They are a kind of religion or an anti-religion. They have initiation into the party as a kind of baptism. They have self-criticism as a kind of confession of sins, re-education as a kind of penance, and elevation to hero of the party as a kind of sainthood. And of course, at least Mao has a kind of everlasting life as a photo smiling down on Tiananmen Square and as an embalmed corpse in a casket in the square. But the party and its members do not have souls. In fact, they are dead men walking because the truth is not in them." The truth is not in them. I mean, it's sort of an update of C.S. Lewis's Men Without Chests. But I like the Jimmy Lai formulation.
Well, this is an important story to go back and look at, especially at this time. We're about ready to celebrate Independence Day. And honestly,
a sparsely attended barbecue thanks to our Maoist impersonator, Joe Biden.
Yeah, because we didn't get to 70% vaccination rate. Is that right?
We failed your leader.
So you can have 10 in your backyard, Dan, or 10 on your porch, Dan?
Yeah. I don't congregate with groups of people anyway, so it doesn't really affect me. But
just you and Hayek?
I just like the idea of the sparsely attended barbecue that was promised as a treat for us, you know, the way that New York State is promising inmates conjugal visits to get vaccinated.
You saw that. No, they get $75 gift certificates to some of the best food you can purchase in the prison commissary if they get vaccinated.
Thank you, dear leader. Thank you, dear leader.
Far removed from George Washington before going into battle in 1776. Quote, "The time is now near at hand, which must probably determine whether Americans are to be free men or slaves, whether they are to have any property they can call their own, whether their houses and farms are to be pillaged and destroyed, and themselves consigned to a state of wretchedness from which no human efforts will deliver them."
Well, he was just a slave owner. Nobody listens to George Washington anymore. That's so passe. As Jimmy Lai notes, we're busily writing our new history. And I'm sorry. I'm sorry, General Washington, you're not a part of it. You're out. Sorry.
Mm-hmm. No more pledging your sacred honor, your life, your fortunes, your sacred honor for the right thing, to do the right thing. But, you know, what an example here. He's a billionaire. He could capitulate. He's a British citizen. He could have laid down and done nothing and had a nice life.
But the problem
is in prison.
But the problem is he knows the truth.
Yeah, that's right.
And that's quite a burden in this world. He told the Knapp Institute recently, "If you believe in the Lord, if you believe that all suffering has a reason and the Lord is suffering with me, will definitely define the person I'm becoming, so I'm at peace with it. I am what I am. I am what I believe. I cannot change it. And if I can't change it, I have to accept my fate with praise.
What a contrast to Cardinal Supich. Lai is a Catholic, although he wasn't always one. This is from the Federalist article.
Yeah.
He met the faith through his wife, a pious woman he accompanied to church, where he heard the homilies of Cardinal Joseph Zen, and in 1997 was baptized into the church by the same great man. And now we have Catholic bishops in the suburbs and also in Wisconsin taking priests out of their commission because they didn't want to comply with some of these lockdown orders, and they're preaching truth. Father James Parker out in Batavia, taken out of his role, not reassigned, and sitting there with, you know, apparently no housing support or anything because the Rockford bishop didn't like his attitudes towards the COVID shutdown.
Well, you know, it's a great country, but I don't know. I don't know if people think it's worth fighting for anymore. I mean, it's worth fighting for the creature comforts. It's worth fighting for your transfer payment. But I mean, in terms of the vision of the country, an experiment guided by Providence. I don't know. Somebody's going to call me a name. My kid might not get into the school I want him to get into. I could suffer economically. You know, so, yeah, I really respect what Jimmy Lai is doing, but would I do that? No.
Mm-mm.
Mm-mm. Mm-mm. Solson Heenson in 1983, speaking of a forerunner to Jimmy Lai. I've mentioned this speech before because I think it's one of his best. I mean, you should read Gulag Archipelago, but the speech where he was awarded the Templeton Prize that he gave in London, ironically, Jimmy Lai, British citizen, as you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
He talked about what happened with the Russian Revolution to, well, present at that time in 83, before the wall fell, obviously. And this goes back to Frank in Arlington Heights saying the proper term for the individuals we've been talking about who are rewriting history anew in real time is Bolsheviks. He said that said in this speech, the events of the Russian Revolution can only be understood now at the end of the century against the background of what has since occurred in the rest of the world. What emerges here is a process of universal significance. And if I were called upon to identify briefly the principal trait of the entire 20th century, here I would be unable to find anything more precise and pithy than to repeat, men have forgotten God. That's his summation of the 20th century in one sentence. And what of the 21st century? Have we remembered? Are we remembering, or are we doing more forgetting? He went on to say, the failings of human consciousness, deprived of its divine dimension, have been a determining factor in all the major crimes of the 20th century. And then he goes through them. We could recount them. It seems to me that, you know, we're at this crossroads, a time for choosing, to borrow from Reagan at the 64 convention. And it was actually articulated half a century ago, more than that, by Bishop Fulton Sheehan, who Jimmy Lai also has great affinity for, yep. Has read and listened to his speeches, and that informed his Catholicism as well. Bishop Fulton Sheehan on the choice before us, 60 years ago, Jefferson or St. Just? What's it going to be?
Those are the two principles. And isn't it interesting that that particular government and those governments in the world that deny the existence of God are those that deny the existence of human rights? Now, let's go to Saint-Just. What did Saint-Just, and along with him Royer, what was their principle? Their principle was that in order to make people pass through a certain door, there was only one way to do it, and that was the way of terror. Confiscation of property and the destruction of rights and liberties. Saint-Just also said, a people can be taught to save themselves only by violence. And the path to the establishment of every government must be upon a pile of corpses. That was the thing that Jefferson had to fight against when he wrote the Declaration of Independence. He knew it. It wasn't anything new. I'm bringing it up now to remind you that we're going through exactly that same crisis now that Jefferson faced. That our country today has to choose once more between Jefferson and Saint-Just. Which are we going to choose?
Well, I don't know. Which are we choosing? By the way, Saint-Just was Robespierre's angel of death in the French Revolution. So Russian Revolution, French Revolution, and the Cultural Revolution in America going on. It ended poorly for Robespierre and Saint-Just. But that's not to say that you can't have a good run of piling up corpses before that occurs, as Robespierre and Saint-Just did. So what's it going to be on this Independence Day, where, as a country, at least half of it can't even bring itself to denounce Chinese communists who spent 35 years murdering little girls in their one-child policy?
Yep.
Go watch One Child Nation.
Oh.
Now have concentration camps set up for minority Muslim population. And we genuflect before the NBA and Disney, who genuflect before the Chi-Coms. Which are we choosing, Jefferson or Saint-Just? Knowingly or unknowingly? Candace in Mount Pleasant.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. You know, just your point that you just made about the Muslims in China, it's not just them, it's the Falun Gong too, who are like the hippies of China. They're using them for organs. But anyway, I digress. Dan, I'm just wondering, why is iHeartRadio putting commercials while you guys are talking? Like, I think they're doing it on purpose. So I think you guys should talk to them about that. Because they're running commercials during the show.
I don't know.
Weird.
Okay. Beyond my pay grade, but okay.
Okay, my second point was Vicki McKenna yesterday up here on 11:30 a.m. had the ex-scientist of Pfizer, and he said that they're totally lying to people when they say that, you know, they have done studies on kids and that it's safe. And he was also talking about the VAERS system and how inaccurate it is and how the numbers are much higher of people having occurrences, because a lot of people don't even know that the VAERS system exists. And even if they do, a lot of their doctors are persuading them not to report or telling them it's all in their head.
We've talked a lot about this. Okay.
Okay. And then the other thing is there's either an NBA player or a football player up here whose wife had a really horrible result from the jab, and he couldn't get any help from his doctor or anything. So he went on Facebook and he found like 2,000 other people like him. So now he's forming a group up here in Wisconsin. And Ron Johnson, I'm amazed, is, you know, speaking out with this guy, you know, and what's going on, that so many people are getting injured and nobody's doing anything for him. And he said, it's crazy that people are in trials. When you're in a trial, if something happens to somebody, you don't just throw them out of the study and ignore them. And that's what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. We're just living through lunacy. It's crazy.
Thanks for the call, Candace. You know, the people who spend all their time telling you how much they care about other people and how many lives they're saving. Do you ever notice that they communicate that with data, like Chuck Todd did, we were talking about earlier? Not actual individual stories, what they're specifically doing for a actual human being. Saving lives is an abstraction. It's a talking point. Caring about other human beings, it's an abstraction for them. It's a talking point. These are your new Marxists. These are your new Bolsheviks. These are your new Jacobins. So what's it going to be? Jefferson or St. Jude's?
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and in for Amy J. This morning is former state rep and GOP congressional and gubernatorial candidate Jeanne Ives. And Jeanne, I'm sure you've noticed that Texas Governor Greg Abbott has been rounding up a posse around the country with help from his colleagues, other Republican governors, sending help for him to the border to address the crisis that roils Texas because of the Biden administration's de facto open border policy. Well, yesterday there was a suit filed in federal court in Galveston, a suit filed by a number of sheriffs in Texas as well as ICE officers. And it was counsel, I should say, representing those law enforcement officials in that suit is former Kansas Secretary of State and now General Counsel of the Alliance for Free Citizens, Chris Kobach, who joins us now. Chris, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Great to be with you guys.
So the basis for the suit that you filed?
Well, the Biden administration in February issued a memorandum, and this memorandum was truly earth-shattering. It told ICE officers that they now may not deport people that they routinely would have deported unless they're in a very tiny category of aggravated felons who've committed very severe felonies. But 90% of the deportees that they would have deported without a second thought, they were not allowed to do so unless they got special approval from their very high superiors. And as it's worked out, that approval virtually never happens. And so ICE is basically being ordered by their political overlords to break the law, because back in the 90s, Congress passed three different federal laws that say you shall deport people in this category and you must detain people in that category, and there's no discretion left. So basically, this Biden administration policy is asking ICE officers to break the law, and as a result, sheriff's departments in Texas are just, their jails are full. Aliens they would have transferred to ICE for deportation, ICE is no longer taking them, and even worse, in Texas right now, when illegal aliens finish their prison sentence, whether they're serving it in a prison or in a county jail, normally they would have been immediately, a phone call would have been made to ICE, and ICE would come over and pick them up and deport them. Now ICE is telling them, sorry, under the new policies, you got to let them loose on the streets.
And so you're seeking a declaratory judgment from federal court and probably an injunction against this
Correct.
Federal policy?
Correct. We're merely asking the judge, please allow the ICE officers to follow the law, and that will in turn help the sheriffs better restore order in their own counties in Texas, which are just being overrun right now.
I know we're short on time with you, but you've been had real profile on this area of the law as well. And by the way, I should mention you're a Harvard law grad, so you don't have to. You know how that goes.
Actually, Yale law, but that's close.
Anyway, Harvard undergrad? Would you go to Harvard undergrad?
That's right.
See, I know what you did. You made me say Harvard law so you could get the Yale in, too. So now you got the Harvard and the Yale. You guys, you Ivy Leaguers. All right, I wanted to get your take on the Supreme Court decision in the Arizona case, the Arizona voting rights case. Ban on ballot harvesting, requirement voters cast ballots on election day. Both of those strictures to voting in Arizona upheld in a 6-3 decision by the court, which is now being decried, of course, by the Democrat socialists as the end of our democracy and its representative republic. Mm-hmm. But I quibble. Your reaction to that decision and the reaction of the expected reaction of the left to it?
Well, as the former Secretary of State of Kansas and someone who was the chief voting official for the state and someone who's litigated these issues in court as well, it should have been a 9-0 decision. These are so clearly consistent with federal statute. They're consistent with the Constitution. I think it was a bogus legal challenge from the start. And, you know, the way the left has successfully agitated on this issue, where things that are incredibly popular, the states like Kansas and many others that have no ID, the numbers are off the charts. You see 80% support among all racial groups. And yet the left is telling African-Americans, no, this is racist, this hurts you. And they say, no, we like it. So the idea that these types of very common sense restrictions are unconstitutional or violate federal law is simply wrong.
Have you followed the Arizona election audit closely? And what is your prediction on that?
Well, it's hard to make a prediction because, you know, we're hoping the auditors are absolutely faithful and objective. And, you know, I'm guessing that they will find irregularities just because the numbers in Arizona did look a little odd, but I don't know whether they will find irregularities that were big enough to have changed the outcome. We'll see. I've spoken to some of the legislators and worked with them in Arizona, not on the audit, but on some election reform bills, coincidentally. But these are the legislators who are involved in driving the audit. And one thing I'm really heartened by is they are determined to see this audit through and get this information out to the public, whatever it may be. And so I think one way or another, there will be a decision, a result from the audit, which shows whatever it shows. And I think that's good because there's so much political pressure on these Arizona legislators to just shut up and go away.
He is former Kansas Secretary of State Chris Kobach, now the general counsel of the Alliance for Free Citizens, representing those law enforcement officials in Texas who filed suit against the Biden administration so they can do their jobs. Chris Kobach, thanks so much for joining us. Good luck with that suit.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And he joined us on the Turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Dan and in for Amy this morning, former state rep Jeannie Ives, now at breakthrough-ideas.com. You hear her reveille commentaries on our airwaves weekly. Jeannie, we were talking about the voting rights case the Supreme Court ruled on, closing out its term. You want to talk a little bit, but by the way, just in Arizona, with all of the histrionics from the left, Arizona allows voters to vote by mail or in person for nearly a month before Election Day. But the left is apoplectic about their ban on ballot harvesting and a requirement voters cast ballots on Election Day in the precinct of the county where they're registered. That's just too onerous. That's something, again, the bigotry of low expectations, something minorities can't figure out how to do, according to Democrat socialists. But it's just best practices, according to people who want to have free and fair elections. And you've been doing some due diligence in your home county, in my former home county of DuPage, on the topic.
Well, vote by mail is very popular in DuPage County, according to official records that I received from the county clerk, because I asked for the voter records in June. I got these June 1st, so this is not old data, but according to those records, let's see, Grant Hone lives at 304 Pine Lane in Bensonville. He actually doesn't live there anymore. He's 121 years old, and he actually voted by mail in 2020.
Yep. Well, 121, you can't get around as well as you used to.
Yeah. So did Peggy Schmidt. She's 121. And so did Teresa LaCastro. She's 119. Now, if those three people reside in DuPage County, we need to know what's in the water, because they would literally be the three oldest people in the entire world.
Do they not register? Did they move to Florida, too, or what's the deal?
No, but Teresa apparently actually voted at her polling place, according to official documents I have from the DuPage County.
She's the 119-year-old?
Yes, she's the 119-year-old. She walked in and voted in her polling place.
Let me hazard a guess here. I'm going to guess that those three individuals have already passed on to their eternal reward.
Yes, I believe so. However, of course, I sent this information to the state's attorney in DuPage County, and they investigated. They went to their clerk's office and they said, "What's going on here?" Well, apparently, when we did not previously require birth dates for voter registration, and so when they started to require that in the 1970s, and they couldn't get all the information, they just set as a date January 1st of 1900. So they these people could conceivably. What? Maybe they were born in 1950 or something, but that actually is not the case. They would look further into these records for me, and they said, well, actually, these people didn't vote. I said, I'm looking at the record that shows that they voted in 2020, and there's, 650,000 records in this database they gave me. Is every one of these wrong? Well, no, Jeannie, they didn't actually vote. There's a separate database that the DuPage County clerk has that shows who actually voted.
Are they actually 121 and 119? Oh. Do they know that? They don't know that?
They...
Are they alive? Do they know that?
No, they're not alive.
They're not alive.
But my records show that they voted. They say that there's another database, another record-keeping source that shows that they actually are not marked as voting. I said, well, then who...
So they're marked in voting in the voter file you got from DuPage County.
Yes, official.
But in another voter file, they tell you they're marked as not voting, or they're not marked as voting.
That's right. So why can't I have the other? This is exactly what I was told.
And also in DuPage County, there was a recent announcement of an indictment of some Democrat operative for voter fraud.
Yes, Susan Cain, or Dr. Susan Cain, but you don't
use
doctor.
Is she a medical doctor?
She's not a medical doctor. So Susan Cain, age 64. She's 64.
Doctor in education, botany, what is it?
I don't remember.
I don't know.
Psychology,
yeah.
Who knows?
Yeah.
But she voted. I mean, she committed, allegedly, voter fraud. She was arrested and hauled in for, I think, four counts of forgery. It was, and she was the Democrat, Milton Democrat trustee candidate.
She ran for Milton Township.
Yes, ran for Milton Township,
preserve democracy, I presume.
That's exactly what she said. She said that in an open statement. I think it was at a League of Women Voters forum.
She's so committed to preserving democracy, she's willing to commit voter fraud. I mean, that is somebody who's really committed.
Mm-hmm.
That's inspired stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But I thought voter fraud is just like a right wing conspiracy. It doesn't happen. And as we see from New York City with their pristine mayoral election, there's asking questions about the administrative elections is just all the stuff of perpetrating big lies. So I don't want to do that. I don't want to ask questions. Now, Eric Adams apparently wants to ask questions about how the New York City election authority ran the election there.
How Trumpian of him.
Yeah. Sounds like
where's the outcry there?
Sounds like a big liar. Like anybody asking questions about the 2020
conspiracy
election.
Conspiracy theorist.
Yeah. Part of, all those right-wing mayoral candidates in New York City. Sure.
Oh, we just had 135,000, what was it? What do they call those ballots? Oh, they were, they threw in 135,000 test ballots.
Yeah, test ballots.
Right.
And then they had to correct
that.
And
we had to correct that. Yeah.
And now you can be confident
nothing
in the correction, of
here.
Course.
Nothing to see here.
Tony in Downers Grove.
Hey, Dan, you should delve into or talk a little bit more about the law that was just passed in Illinois by Governor Pritzker, which when reported on, if you read about it, in the beginning, it's like, oh, this sounds good. Oh, wait, curbside voting, voting in prisons, and my favorite, you don't have to be registered in the precinct to vote in a different precinct. All this without voter ID.
Thanks for the call.
Well,
Tony.
Add to that automatic vote by mail. So permanent vote by mail, rather.
Mm-hmm.
So if you are
vote by mail, vote by jail.
If you're 100. Yeah. That's right. So if you're you can be on the voter list, you can be 121 and you could have made yourself a permanent voter where you're always getting sent a ballot. You could have done that when you were 89 and now you're 121 and you're still getting sent that. ballot application.
Mike Scott has reported on this, but I don't know if he answered the question I had. Can you just pre-vote, you know, so or have somebody pre-vote for you so you can just vote for the Democrat candidate every – I know we don't have straight ticket voting anymore, but have somebody just, you know, machine learning, AI, just vote for the Democrat candidate in every race in perpetuity, including after you've passed on.
You know, you put the first first letter in to the Google search box and it knows what you want.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. Because with technology, we don't need ward healers anymore. We don't need people doing the ballot harvesting. Just have computers take care of it. And then we don't have to have all this messiness and all these right-wing conspiracy theorists like the DuPage County State's Attorney prosecuting this poor woman for voter fraud, or Eric Adams prosecuting the election authority in New York City for what the hell their tally was, and so on and so forth. It's just so messy. And, you know, I want to preserve democracy as much as Chuck Schumer.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You switched to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan, and in for Amy J this morning, former state rep and GOP congressional and gubernatorial candidate Jeannie Ives, who is also a West Point grad. In case you didn't know, I should really step out of this conversation and let you and our next guest chat. Andrew Biggio is United States Marine Corps Infantry Sergeant. He currently is a Boston, Massachusetts police officer as well. And he's got a new book out, The Rifle, Combat Stories from America's Last World War II Veterans Told Through an M1 Garand. And you had some, you were telling me some pithy sloganeering you all did at your time at the academy about your rifle. Tell us. You have to turn your microphone on so people can hear you. Oh, there you go.
Oh, is it on?
Okay.
Oh, okay. Right. I have no control here.
Yeah,
you're controlling the audio.
Right.
So you can
controlling
just
the audio and visual.
You can cut me off right after this comment. You'll probably cut me off. I mean, who knows what the lines will probably light up. But, I mean, you know, when I went to West Point, brand new cadet, really very much new to all this stuff, hadn't really held a weapon before. And we always called it our weapon. And the reason for that is the quip at West Point was, this is my weapon, this is my gun. One is for fighting, the other's for fun.
Wow. You ladies at West Point were pretty profane.
Well,
wow.
No, I heard that from the guys at West Point.
Oh, I see.
That came from the guys, obviously.
I see. Okay.
But we refer to them as weapons, and he's referred, this is the rifle M1 Garand is referred to as the weapon that won World War II.
I want to, I wonder, it's just a hazard, I guess. I wonder if there was any pithy sloganeering in the Marine Corps. I wonder if they had any sayings they like to share. Andrew Biggio, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Have you heard that one before? This is my weapon and this is my rifle.
Yep.
Yeah.
We had the Marine Corps, we had the Rifleman's Creed.
What is that?
This is my rifle. There are many other like it, but this one is mine. And then it went on to, you know, what our rifle does to protect us and stuff I can't say on the radio. So.
Okay. All right. Good. I should have joined the Marine Corps just for the
slogans.
Yeah. Just for the banter. Because I think that's mostly what people go into the services, right? For the banter,
you would
the camaraderie.
You would add some philosophical sort of references totally over their heads.
The metaphor, I would have been to the Marine Corps what Leaping Lanny Poffo was to world wrestling, which is the poet laureate of WWF. That would have been me in the Marine Corps. Marine Corps could use a poet laureate, perhaps. Andrew, I want to talk to you a little bit about being a police officer these days, too, but the book, The Rifle, Combat Stories from America's Last World War II Veterans. Tell us a little bit about the genesis of this book.
Sure. Well, I came back from Iraq and Afghanistan and really just simply wanted to seek out America's last World War II veterans on how to live a successful life after combat. I thought it would be, you know, when I found out the last World War I veteran died in 2011, I realized the whole generation of veterans had disappeared before our eyes, and I knew it was going to be a race against time, but the World War II veterans were not far behind, basically. So I wanted to rush and collect as much wisdom and advice from them as possible before we lost our World War II veterans, which we are. We're losing almost 1,000 a day. There's less than 300,000 of them. And I thought it was important for our youngest veterans of this country to bond with the oldest.
Well, give us a you know, perhaps one of the most compelling or surprising combat stories you were able to glean from the World War II vets you spoke with.
So I did something unique. So basically, you know, I wasn't the first person to write a book about World War II. So in my journeys, I brought with me an M1 Grand, which was the standard rifle of that time. It was the most issued rifle of that time. It was every veteran was going to have some sort of memory or feeling with this because it was the first thing that they were handed once they got sent away from home. They were drafted. You know, they were used in boot camp or they actually used it in physical combat. So with me, I would bring an M1 Grand, simply meet up with this veteran and say, hey, do you remember this? And hand them the rifle. And when they lit up, like they were 19 years old again or just stared at it, the weapon acted like a microphone, really. So I had all these veterans just telling me all their memories with this M1 Grand, whether it was basic training or whether it was the Battle of Okinawa or the Battle of the Bulge. The stories would just come out, and I did this over 200 times. I brought this rifle. And, of course, when I'm bringing the rifle to their home, I'm having them sign their name to it, so on the wooden stock. So I collected over 200 names in about 5 years, and I had to pick 17 of what I thought were the best stories for my book, The Rifle.
Wow, that's a cool way to do it too. That's very creative. I mean, to get them talking too. I mean, it sounds like something could be optioned into a series of some sort. Maybe Netflix or Amazon will come calling.
Well, I spent my time in the Army, primarily in Germany, and of course, World War II, you know, was prominent in our mind. I was still there during the Cold War, and then I actually was stationed there in 89 when the wall fell, so you did see the fruition of leadership under Ronald Reagan and others that made that happen. Leadership matters. And we got, I very got invested in researching a lot more about World War II. You know, one of my favorite stories from World War II is that of the Intelligence and Reconnaissance Platoon from the 394th Infantry Regiment of the 99th Infantry Division, which is the most decorated platoon of World War II. This is Lyle Bauck. He's 20 years old, and he essentially, you know, disrupts the enemy and holds off the German 6th Panzer's army long enough so that we can reconstitute on the back end and basically make sure that that Hitler's last stance fails. And, you know, he and his 18 men held out for nearly, you know, 18 hours against the enemy. And these stories need to be told and retold and retold. And that story is actually retold in a book called The Longest Winter by Alex Kershaw.
So for once, I'm on a radio station where you actually taught me something. So that's amazing. Yeah, I'm very familiar with the 99th Division. There's a couple survivors in here, but that's the first time I heard about that platoon. That's really great.
Well, and it's interesting to me, too, because Lyle Bauck's son, Dwight Bauck, lives in Wheaton and in my neighborhood.
Wow.
Interesting. And
Does he want to sign the rifle?
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, right. You know, you had this idea and you pursued it, and then you came up with this innovation using the M1 as the microphone, as you said. So then what did you come away with after 200 interviews of 200 different World War II veterans?
It's a great question. Many different things, but I think what the first thing was a lot of us, you know, the Iraq and Afghanistan veterans, we all rose our hand and enlisted after 9/11. And I was interviewing each World War II veteran and what they did because of Pearl Harbor. You know, they raised their hand, they wanted to defend their nation. And I started to slowly realize that they were no different than the men and women today who really wanted to just serve their country and if needed, give their lives for the betterment of the world. And they are the greatest generation, but each veteran would, you know, would tell me, like, listen, this whole greatest generation, you know, we sometimes we did things that weren't so great in order to win the war. So don't live in our shadows. Don't try. We're not gods. Don't try to be like us. Don't. We were just ordinary men who were thrown into an extraordinary time. And a lot of them really were driving that point home when each time I met them. They told me a lot about the brutal force that was used to win in the Pacific. They, you know, a lot of the bombing and chaos and war crimes that were used even in Europe against the Germans in order to win. It was just won by complete brute force, and it wasn't all just swing dancing, milkshakes, and victory parades as like we see a lot in the movies and stuff.
I wonder too. Like, you know, you see this in some of the interviews in that series, Band of Brothers. The interviews at the end of the episodes, and so many of the stories, particularly as these World War II veterans have gotten older, are about those who didn't make it back. Their brothers who they saw die in combat with them. And then, you know, especially when you reflect on it now, when they're in their 70s, 80s, 90s now, and say, boy, the life I led, and then, you know, my friend that I served with back in World War II didn't make it out, never had the chance to experience this subsequent 80 years of life that I experienced.
Yeah, I mean, the first part of... So basically, the book starts off with me coming home from Iraq and Afghanistan, and my name is Andrew Biggio. And every day, I have to pass Andrew Biggio Square in my town.
Wow.
It's not for me. It's my grandfather's brother who was killed at 19 years old. 19. Didn't get to have a career, a girlfriend, a wife, a go to college, a job, have kids. 19. What do you know at 19 besides poor kid gets killed in the hills of Italy, all right? Fighting with the 34th Division. So I started to read his last letters home before he was killed, and that's how he wrote about how much he enjoyed the M1 Garand. He was telling his mother about the rifle he was carrying. So I had to go out and buy one. I wanted to feel what he felt, hold what he held, try to tell his story if possible. And the best way to do that would be bring that M1 Garand to these other veterans so they could tell me and help tell Andy's story, because Andy couldn't. So naturally, at the end of the book, I find survivors who are with them in that hill in Italy.
Hmm. Wow.
That's cool.
Wow.
Yeah, that's cool. The book, The Rifle, Combat Stories from America's Last World War II Veterans Told Through an M1 Garand. Andrew Biggio is the author. He's also a United States Marine Corps infantry sergeant, and as he mentioned, Afghanistan and Iraq veteran. He serves as a police officer now in Boston, Massachusetts. Andrew, thanks so much for joining us. Good luck with the book.
Thanks for having me, sir.
And he joined us on the Turnkey.pro answer line.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, but in for Amy this morning is former state representative and GOP congressional and gubernatorial candidate Jeannie Ives. And Jeannie, the June jobs number is out. 850,000 new jobs in June. Hoorah! Things are going well, which is why I'm perplexed at our friend Carol Watt's new book, The War on Small Business. How the government used the pandemic to crush the backbone of America. What? As I understand it from our intellectual immortal superiors, like Triple Threat and Jelly Belly, the Biden administration obviously goes without saying, they saved lives and now they're saving jobs. Propped up business with the PPP program and all of the relief that is all stimulative. That's what I understand from them. And now we're getting back to opening. Look how everything is normal. Chicago's getting back to normal. You got an alderman indicted. Everything is
Alder person, Dan.
Yeah. All right. Fair enough. But everything's back to how it's supposed to be. So what's all the caterwauling about this war on small business and government being a problem? Government's been the savior. Carol Roth, former investment banker, entrepreneur, author of The War on Small Business, How the Government Used the Pandemic to Crush the Backbone of America. Carol, I think you got a hard case to make out. 850,000 jobs in June. What are you complaining about?
Yeah, well, you know, only a couple months ago, we were expecting a million. So, you know, when you continue to lower that bar, it looks really good, Dan, doesn't it? You know, this is really about winners and losers and who's getting those jobs and, you know, who's really stuck holding the bag. If you look back at last year, you had a government who decided who was essential and who was non-essential, who was going to thrive and who was going to fight to survive, and that was based not on data or science, but on political clout and connections. And that ended up enabling the most historic wealth transfer that we've ever seen in our lifetime from Main Street to Wall Street. Yes, you had seven tech companies gain $3.4 trillion in value, and it was a record year for IPOs and for the big guys. But as we know, by the middle of last year, we had 400,000 small businesses that had closed permanently. We had millions more who are fighting to survive. So if you look at the whole picture, sure, they can paint a rosy one for you, but if you start to peel back the onion, this is really a consolidation of power and a moving away from free market, decentralized small businesses to a handful of big businesses and big governments.
Yeah, but Illinois incomes are up 17% year over year, and savings rates are up because of the income's up and because there's been less supply of the things people want. So yeah, okay. So maybe you took my business
Dan,
away.
Dan, do the math though.
Well, maybe you took my business away, but hey, you gave me some cash and some child tax credits, and you promised to continue sending drop shipping cash to me in perpetuity. So, you know, things aren't bad.
Yeah, it's always good when you're starving for them to give you a crumb that's going to let you continue to survive one more day, and then they can decide if they're going to give you more. You know, what's really disappointing here is you talk about things like the stimulus checks and all of this, you know, kind of little payoff so they could say, you know, we did our part. What happened on the small business front is they really got a fraction of what they deserved. I mean, the government came in, they subjugated their property rights. They said, we're going to take your business for the good of society. Mm-hmm. And they didn't appropriately compensate the small businesses. And even though we have seen trillions of dollars spent, and as you mentioned, the extended unemployment, the stimulus, all the cash for cronies program, when it came down to it, small businesses who bore the brunt of those government mandates really got a fraction of that. And certainly it wasn't enough to keep them in business. We've seen that here, you know, in the Chicagoland area. I mean, look at something like Southport Lanes. Been around for almost 100 years, couldn't make it. It survived prohibition as a bar, but couldn't survive the government COVID mandates.
Well, you know, and in Illinois, the situation is still dire. So I think those 850,000 jobs, I mean, most of them are probably in surrounding states. The war on business goes on. In the state of Illinois, I mean, we just even the Illinois Chamber of Commerce, who actually kind of plays to both sides, said this was the worst General Assembly for business in generations.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really good point, Jeannie. I mean, we still, even with this jobs report, we're still nearly 7 million jobs down across the country from where we were in February 2020. And you were seeing a differential in terms of the state that decided to opt out of these extended unemployment benefits. Surprise, surprise, you know, that's going to get people back to work when you take mm-hmm. the compensation for staying home away. Obviously, Illinois is not yet one of those states, and so it's certainly not going to have, you know, the same type of outcomes. You know, they never seem to think in a business-friendly manner or in a manner that's actually going to grow the pie and create wealth opportunities for people. They just want to continue to shuffle money around, which net ends up decreasing everybody's wealth.
So the landscape for that small to mid-sized business owner-operator, when the water really recedes and we see what's left, you know, after the eviction moratorium is pulled, after the enhanced unemployment benefits is pulled, when we really see things start to shake out in the third and fourth quarter this year, what does the first quarter of 2022 look like, do you think?
Yeah, I think you're going to end up seeing that millions of small businesses were murdered just based on, you know, the numbers that we're seeing and the trajectory that we're seeing. And we're going to see a continued tilted playing field. I mean, we've seen it for years, whether it's in crazy regulation, licensing, differentials, and taxes. Now the small businesses are getting the quote-unquote de facto minimum wage increase because obviously, you know, the government's been competing with them in terms of employment, and then you're seeing higher prices, you're seeing broken supply chains. And if you think about the economy before COVID, about half of that was 30.2 million small businesses. The other half was about, you know, 10 plus thousand big businesses. And you're just going to see this continued consolidation of power amongst the hands of fewer businesses, which is less economic freedom. And just across the board, if you think about wealth creation opportunities for the individual in America, it's equity ownership, it's ownership of a business, it's being able to buy stocks, it's being able to own a home. And at every turn, the government is interfering with your opportunity as the average American, as the little guy, to create and participate in wealth creation. And that's something that everybody should be concerned about. And unfortunately, is like the most underreported story of the last 15 months.
You know, but I watch those investotainment channels, and most of the people I see on like CNBC, you know, they cheer this those government interventions you're talking about. Andrew Sullivan wrote last year that we're all on a college campus now talking about the oppressive Jacobin purge that's going on. Maybe we're all rent seekers now, too.
I mean, it's crazy. You know, I've been in the markets for more than a quarter of a century, and, you know, to see it completely move away from free market capitalism to the Federal Reserve disrupting risk in the market the way that it has, those people, and, you know, many of them I've worked with before, many of them I continue to work with, you know, they're seeing the benefits of that. They are in the in club. They're the ones who are getting the benefits of free money from the taxpayer, basically, to go out and make additional investments and increase their wealth. So, you know, yeah, they're cheering it on. But that doesn't mean if you take a step back and look at the broader economy or think about history, when you have, you know, this consolidation of wealth, not via free markets, but via government mandate, how that ends up turning out for a country. It's not a good thing for everyone. And if you really have that abundance mentality of a free market capitalist, you believe that everyone should have the opportunity to have those wealth creation opportunities. And unfortunately, those are being strangled off.
Well, we don't seem to care about free markets, right? The U.S. wins international backing for a global minimum tax. Do we care anymore about competing against our rivals or what?
I mean, this is bizarre world, Jeannie. I mean, I can't believe that the U.S. is heading up a global cartel to fix
exactly
taxes. I mean, we have completely...
It's price collusion. Price collusion, right? Shouldn't they be charged with that?
I mean, you would think so. Yeah, I lay the case out in the book, The War on Small Business, that we really have moved along the spectrum further away from capitalism to central planning, and you're seeing these geniuses make the same mistakes that they've made before. You know, we saw it with our relationship with China, now we're seeing it with this global minimum tax rate. They want to control everything, and we know when a handful of people make those decisions, they have worse outcomes than you know, if the entire world is doing that by free choice. So it is really bizarre world and should be very concerning to everybody.
On the spectrum, indeed. Carol Roth, former investment banker, entrepreneur, the book, The War on Small Business, How the Government Used the Pandemic to Crush the Backbone of America. Pick it up, The War on Small Business. Carol Roth, thanks so much for joining us.
All right, have a great Freedom Weekend, guys.
You too.
Thank you. Take care.
And she joined us on the Turnkey.pro Answer Line.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and former state rep Jeannie Ives in for Amy J today. And it was interesting, the conversation we had with Carol Roth, Jeannie, because some of the notes that she is striking in her book, War on Small Business, about the rent seeking, the government picking winners and losers, the biggest rent seekers getting the biggest benefits at the expense of the little entrepreneurs. This is also notes that were touched on by J.D. Vance in his bestseller Hillbilly Elegy, optioned into a mediocre movie starring Glenn Close and Amy Adams. And J.D. Vance is now running for the Republican nomination for U.S. Senate to replace Rob Portman in Ohio. He announced and then appeared on Tucker Carlson's show to sort of give his value prop as a candidate.
You have elites in the ruling class that have plundered this country, that have made it harder for middle-class Americans to live a normal life. And when those Americans dare to complain about the conditions of their own country, yeah. if they dare to complain about the southern border or about jobs getting shipped overseas, what do they get called? They get called racists. They get called bigots, xenophobes, or idiots. They need somebody who's willing to speak for them, who's willing to fight for them. And I just want normal Americans to know they still have a voice in this country. They love this country, but they should be able to criticize it when it's not working for them. And right now, it's just not.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's easy to get into a race when you've got a $10 million super PAC behind you at the very beginning.
Peter Thiel backing J.D. Vance's bid for Senate. Yes. You know, and Vance has got some profile and he's got some friends with money. He's been successful in his life and good for him because, I mean, he really did come from nothing and it's a great American story. So I'm interested to see how his candidacy unfolds, but more on the market position that he's trying to occupy. Sort of, I mean, this is not novel anymore, particularly post 2016. But I mean, Angelo Codevilla, Boston U, Professor Emeritus, was writing about the so-called ruling class. You know, almost 10 years before that. But it's starting to sort of get to critical mass, I think, in the public consciousness. And Vance also very willing to go after the, you know, establishment, please clap Republican wing of his own party.
Well, I think so far a lot of them are frustrated and they're a little upset with me because I actually say what's true, which is that many of these people don't care about their own voters. They think they're either bigoted or they think they're stupid. They don't understand their job in this country is to protect their own voters, to serve their best interests.
Yes.
So a lot of establishment Republicans, just like a lot of the mainstream press, a lot of the corporate media, they're against me. They're against me and they're going to be against me. And that's fine.
You know, it seems to me, Jeannie, I know this is a space that you occupied when you did like challenge Bruce Rauner in a Republican primary for governor. But
that was a fun race.
But I don't understand why. I mean, I do understand, but it's sad that even people who aren't cut in on the deal here, cut in on the scam, even the people who aren't part of the it's not broken, it's fixed culture here. Nobody running for office in this state that I'm aware of talks like that. And that seems to me a huge political opportunity for somebody. Do you disagree? Do you agree?
No, I agree. I think that the races in 2022 will be decided largely on the tyranny you do see from the political ruling class and the social issues, the cultural issues that have gone full swing progressive. And I think that's the market space that you have to occupy if you're going to be a challenger in any way to an establishment, Republican or Democrat. Maybe it's just populism, but it's actually just truth at this point. They've gone too far.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Open mic! Open mic Friday! Call in now!
Yeah, it's Open Mic Friday, 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line. Give us a call with your comments, critiques, compliments, crack pottery. Take it all. Housekeeping item. I know a lot of people have inquired about this, and Gail King asks the questions that most of us are afraid to ask so that we learn. The question, obviously, on your mind, is it a diabetic or a person with diabetes? What is the appropriate terminology there?
Before you go, random question here. We were told right before we came on the air not to use the term diabetics, that we should now say people with diabetes because diabetics is considered offensive. Is that true? I just want to make sure we all get it right.
It is the standard now to say it's people with diabetes. Mm. And there's type 1 that Thank requires you, insulin, and type 2 that may or may not require insulin.
All right. Now we know.
The more you know. Thank you, Gail King.
She's not the sharpest knife in the drawer. She's the one who questioned whether or not Prince Philip at 99 years old actually died of natural causes.
Windsurfing. she's a foo. COVID. Foo. Friend of Oprah. So tread lightly. This whole station could be eviscerated if you get on the other side of Gail King. It's so we all have it right. People with diabetes, not diabetic. You know why? This is just my...
P-O-D?
This is my guess.
P-O-W-D?
P-O-W-D?
People. Oh, P-W-D.
Oh, oh, oh,
people
yeah.
with diabetes. People with diabetes. Everything's three letters. P-O-C, P-W-D.
You know what? Because I'm going to guess this is why. It's considered offensive to call somebody a diabetic. Diabetes doesn't define me, man. I'm more than just diabetes. And any other condition or behavior or identity characteristic. I mean, does this get exhausting? But
I'm tired of it.
So if you continue living with your diabetes, are you considered a survivor? Are you a survivor? Everybody's a survivor too.
Well, and you're a victim with diabetes.
We could talk about this with Gail King for hours on end. It's such a fascinating
topic.
Which is topic.
True. It's a terrible disease, by the way.
Well, I know. We're not making fun of diabetics, but it's like he has cancer, she has diabetes, he has MS. I mean, what you're just describing what is. It's not, that's offensive? That's the condition you're dealing with. You know, every word has to be presented on a throw pillow. Frack off. Ron and Evanston, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hello. Two things quick. First, you referred to the former mayor as Tiny Dancer. I think that's rather disrespectful. Me and my friends refer to him as the 9.5-digit midget, but that's not originally why I called. In recent months, I got a job at a major medical manufacturing company in Lake Forest, Illinois, and everyone's coming back to work next week instead of working from home in intervals. They're insisting now that we bring them evidence of our having been vaccinated, and I could tell you any number of stories about how sloppy and inconsistent they are in monitoring people who are and are not fevered, sick, and other things like that.
And you were probably working at Pfizer, aren't you? No, I'm kidding.
Ask me no questions, I'll tell you no lies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay.
Maybe it's Medline.
Yeah, right.
Well, but it's maddening that they have to make me take all these, open up my medical history, and then they can't do anything properly.
Yeah, Ron, you should say, hey, you know, I'm good with the COVID vaccine, but I do have tuberculosis. I don't know if I just thought you should know.
Fine. You're fine. I don't want to have
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
A minute
right.
there. For, you had me worried for a sec.
Yeah.
Thanks, guys.
And thanks. And Ron, announce that in the lunchroom, too. Holly in St. Louis.
Well, good morning. Jeannie, I want to tell you, I judge my politicians the same way I judge my pastors, and that's by the quality of the children they raise. And I
How
love
about your
hearing
radio
about
talk
your
host.
Successful brood. And Dan, I know your imaginary children are outstanding,
Thank
and that's
you.
Why I love you so much.
Thank
but
you.
I want to make a point. 5 years ago this week, we dropped our daughter off at Annapolis, go Navy, beat Army. We spent a week in Washington, D.C. before, and we were out till all hours walking all around that city. We dropped our daughter off on I-Day, spent 3 more days in Annapolis. It was a fantastic transition for our family because she was our oldest kid. This week, a mother doing the exact same thing I did was shot and killed by a stray bullet in Annapolis, dropping her son off for I-Day. And I said to my husband, I don't even think we could do, 5 years later, I don't think we could do in America what we did 5 years ago.
No,
go around D.C. at dark, go out for a late dinner in Annapolis, stroll by the river, by by the water. I don't even think we could do that. So much has changed. And my daughter's also training to be a Navy jet pilot.
So. Oh, terrific. So my son's just coming off of his first deployment with the Eisenhower. He'll be back mid-July. He is a Navy pilot. He's a C-2 pilot. We're very proud of him. He's actually a West Point graduate. He's the traitor in the family. He did cross-commission to the Navy because he wanted to fly for the Navy, which is great.
Because he wanted to have impact.
No, but I mean,
ladies, please.
Oh, my gosh. But, you know, he still roots for the right team in December, so that's why he's allowed home at Christmas and Thanksgiving. But, no, this is such a tragic article. We grabbed it, too. My son found it. My husband found it right away. Naval Academy mom fatally shot while dropping off her son in Annapolis. It is one of the most, you know, important days of your life to drop your son off at college. Really, anyway, where your daughter.
My daughter.
And, you know, and I just, you know, so I wrote on my Facebook page and posted this article. I said, what the hell's going on? This is when you haul in the parents of the shooter and then find out if the guy had a record and was given leniency for other crimes. It has to stop. But it begins with dads and moms raising their kids, right? This guy, they're sitting on the patio of their hotel. Four of them,
right.
Two other, them and another couple. And yeah. Drive-by shooting, she gets shot. What the hell is going on?
I've been at that hotel. Yes.
All right. Hey, can I interject here, if I may? If I can play the role of Gail King here?
Oh, Dan, you're still here.
Yeah, I'm still here.
We thought you'd left.
Since you ladies have raised such outstanding children, I wanted to get your reaction to this news. Elizabeth Gershoff, who is a University of Texas Austin professor, recognized expert on corporal punishment in children. Zero studies found that physical punishment predicted better child behavior over time. In point of fact, physical punishment increases child aggression and other behavioral problems over time. It does not improve children's attention, cognitive ability, social relationships, or social skills. So even though it's legal in like half the states, about 20 states, it's frowned upon by the experts. So I wanted to know, you raised these great kids, both of you. Was corporal punishment a part of it?
Yes, the answer is yes.
Oh. Wow, that was quick. What about you, Holly?
Absolutely not. I have a theory about
another
raising
fight.
Great parents.
And like Army
this.
Navy.
If your parents love each other, you can hardly go wrong. If your parents don't like each other, you can hardly go right. And that's the world according to Holly in St. Louis.
Hmm. All right.
Yeah. Okay. A little swat on the butt kind of woke them up sometimes.
The world according to Holly in St. Louis. All right.
That's correct.
I may have to ghostwrite that book. Thanks for the call, Holly in St. Louis. Good. Bill in Lincoln Park.
Hey, Dan. Hey, Mrs. Ives. That was a great call, the one before that. I can't beat that. Something I want to clarify are that. The governor, I always hear on the radio, well, this is the first time the governor had to work for something. He didn't work for that. He bought that office. Mm-hmm. This guy is not Bill Clinton or Donald Trump. He's not going to get turn on the female vote. So with that, I always hear on the radio, once again, oh yeah, he worked for it. He didn't work, he bought it. So Dan, secondly, and finally, you have hope to become a father, because President Tyler became a father at 54. So I'll leave it at that.
Thanks for the call, Bill. I appreciate that. Wow, it's a lot for me to think about.
Mm-hmm.
But I got to do my John Irving for Holly first, the world according to Holly from St. Louis.
We can take Bob
the
if
world
you
according
want.
To Garp. Oh, we can take Bob.
Yeah, we can take Bob. Yeah. I have a great response for that one.
All right. Bob in Buffalo Grove, you could be walking into Panzer fire here.
good morning, Dan and Jeannie. And Jeannie, we met back in 18 at the Freedom Summit. I want to thank your producers for having Jeannie on as a guest host.
Yeah.
Hopefully
wow.
she'll
thanks,
hopefully Justin, she'll return in 22 when the primaries start. But I got a question for Jeannie and also possibly you. You mentioned that she's a congressional candidate.
Former.
Former.
Oh, are you going to then run in 2022? And what possible district?
All right, that's it. Last question.
No, I'm not taking
any more questions.
Hey, if you know what? If Peter Thiel comes in with a $10 million super PAC.
There you go.
That's my response.
Another question for you, Dan, since you've been pushing, and a lot of people are saying there's going to be a red wave in 22.
Who's saying that?
I'm wondering what congressional seats in Illinois could possibly be flipped.
None. Thanks for the call, Bob. None. Is there one?
It's, no, not the way that they're already considering gerrymandering these districts.
Well,
I mean, they're going to take Rodney Davis from all the college towns, right? Champaign, a little bit up into Bloomington, all the way down into East St. Louis.
Well, flip. First of all, you're going to lose a Republican member of Congress.
You are.
So you're not. There's not going to be any net gains in Illinois. You're just going to continue to hemorrhage because.
But maybe if Peter Thiel gives me $10 million, it'd be fun to have an argument at least.
Yeah.
Just for the argument's sake.
Why don't you just have him like send you a Bitcoin personally and just be happy with that? Amish. Our tin can hotline. Amish texter from Huntley is calling.
Yes, stretch of that tin can over to Genoa City over the border. Good morning, Jeannie. Good morning, Holly. Love you both. And, you know, by the way, diabetics haven't been the same since L. Ron Hubbard died.
Yeah.
But anyhow, I want to know, Jeannie's the expert on the elections here. Have the Democrats proposed voting in our elections by illegals from their country of origin yet?
Oh, yes. Actually, Lori Lightfoot suggested that when the elected school board question came up. She tried to defeat it by saying, well, 20% of the parents of people that are in Chicago school districts are illegal. And they couldn't vote, so that would be unfair representation. So they're all in, and it's actually been suggested in bill format that you do let illegals vote.
No.
But no, country of origin by mail.
Yeah. The wrinkle here is right. You can like the Chicago teachers.
Oh, from country of origin.
Yeah,
sorry.
Like members
from country of origin.
Members of the Chicago Teachers Union could vote from Caracas, for example,
or on the beach of Puerto Rico.
Yeah. Exactly. No, I think it's great. Yeah. I think that's really sharp.
Well, they went to pandemic voting rules in the state legislature. I'm sure this is the next step.
Why not be able to vote from country of origin? Mm-hmm. Why make people come here illegally when they can just vote from their country of origin and send their kids here for school? it's smart. Amish, you know, cutting through some of the red tape here. I like it. Ralph and Rantoul.
Yeah, or just vote by phone like American Idol. Hey, I was in my doctor's office a few years ago. So word of the wise, walls are thin. I heard somebody talking to the doctor about, she was suffering from sugar diabetes. And, you know, the doctor went out into the hallway and then immediately with a couple of the staff people began a really, really nasty mocking thing, saying, well, of course it's sugar. It's just diabetes. What do you think? There's salt diabetes? Do you think there's hamburger diabetes? That's what it is. And I thought, wow. That was the side of the doctor I hadn't known, but it was still kind of funny hearing him, carry on out in the hallway.
Yeah, I like
put my vote in now, too.
I like the the doctor who is not afraid of a little ridicule of, you know, dumb questions or dumb statements. I like that. But now did when he said, did he refer to diabetics or did he say people with diabetes?
No, he wasn't very wordy. He said diabetic. And he was also talking to the woman's equally as aged husband who had just sustained a serious fall and they needed to drive home because it was getting dark and they were afraid to drive in the dark. And he said, you need to get to the hospital to make sure that there's nothing going on inside your head. We'll help you get a ride home. And I just, I was there with my aged mom. Mm-hmm. And I thought, you know, getting old is not for sissies.
Thanks for the call, Ralph. Yeah, it's true. Mm. Some people will be celebrating the 100th anniversary of the Chinese communist lordship over that country. Many members of the D.C. and Chicago Press Corps, Chicago Teachers Union. Tom in Blue Island, I think, is celebrating Independence Day.
Hey, good morning, Dan. Jeannie, good morning. Jeannie, I supported you wholeheartedly against that pimp Rauner. He should have stepped aside and let you run. I don't think you would have much had a chance against Fathead. He might have tried to bear hug you. That being said, I have the ultimate respect for your military family. I want to wish everyone a happy 4th of July. I think there is a specific military relationship to fireworks. And the military ain't going to have anything on the fireworks we're about to see in the city of Chicago this weekend, because they're going to show everyone how to shoot it up.
No.
Well, the sad thing is,
thanks for the call, Tom. That's not true.
Well, the sad thing is there's no fireworks anymore at Mount Rushmore. Biden shut it down.
Yeah, I thought they're getting privately funded, though.
No, I didn't sound that way.
Oh, really?
Latest. Mm. Just shutting it down completely.
Well, don't worry about violence in Chicago this weekend.
Oh,
because
right.
Because Superintendent Brown says they have a safety plan for the weekend. So you know, they finally getting around to that safety plan, so now everything's
fine. They didn't want to have one last week when there were 70, you know, killed.
Well now they
or 70
shot. Yeah.
70 shot.
Yeah. Well, now they got one.
Or,
and
or
so,
this morning when the 9-year-old got shot in the head. They don't care about that either. But now they have a plan for the weekend.
So it's fine. Mm-hmm. Everything's fine.
July 5th, it all
connect
goes
with
back.
Dan and
Elliot and Wilmette.
Hi, I was hoping to hear from you about the Polish-Canadian preacher, whoever you can send contributions.
FECUnited.com is mm-hmm. his website that details the tour that he's doing. We're talking about Artur Pawlowski, who was in Elmhurst this week. We talked to him, I think it was Wednesday.
That would be Pawlowski, but go ahead.
Pawlowski, what did I say?
You said Pawlowski, but it's actually Pawlowski.
Pawlowski, yeah. Okay.
Never mind.
All right.
Thanks very much.
FECUnited.com. FECUnited.com for Pawlowski. I say that right. Chuck and Delavan to close out the week and usher us into the holiday weekend.
Yes. So a 9-year-old shot in the head. That was the name of my garage band when I was in high school. So thank you, Jeannie, for mentioning it.
Too soon.
Everybody get out this weekend. I appreciate you guys letting me talk on your show. I'm like a rock star anywhere I go now. Everybody like, wow, you're Chuck from Delavan. I got my white shoes all ready to go. Get out this weekend, go do some partying, and remember you're an American. God bless everybody.
Thank you, Chuck.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.